This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Hey there, cat lovers. Welcome to Nine Lives with Dr. Cat. I'm your host, Dr. Catherine Krim, and I am a small animal veterinarian and crazy cat lover. I have with me today a special guest, Dr. Craig Clifford. Dr. Clifford is a veterinary oncologist, and he graduated from my alma mater, Mississippi State University, so I know he is wonderful, and we are going to learn a lot about cancers in cats. So we'll be right back.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations, too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Nine Lives with Dr. Cat on Pet Life Radio. I have with me today Dr. Craig Clifford. Hi, Dr. Clifford.
Hi, how are you doing?
I am doing great. So everyone that listens to this show kind of knows that I like for the show to be a source of really good information because the internet is full of some that is not really good, and I want to counter that a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I'm a medical oncologist by trade, so my types of treatment are having patients that have been diagnosed with cancer come in. We usually sit down and have a consultation with the owner where we'll talk about the disease, how the disease is normally treated, and then we pull all of it back to their pet and what we would recommend. And then we leave the owner with, you know, options moving forward. So we always try to make sure we can give them as many options as possible for them to be able to, you know, make a family decision, because as you're well aware in the States, you know, the penetrance of health insurance in pets is rather low. So that means the cost is all out of pocket. So we usually try to provide our owners with multiple options that can potentially be useful for all budget types.
So, Dr. Clifford, how long have you been doing medical oncology in the veterinary sphere?
I started my residency in 2000, so it's been about just about 25 years now of being a medical oncologist.
Excellent. We appreciate your expertise for sure. Can you tell us a little bit about the most common cancers that you see in cats?
Sure. You know, by far, number one cancer that we come across is a cancer of the immune system called lymphoma. Specifically, it's a cancer of lymphocytes, which are cells of the immune system that help fight off infection. And in cats, we tend to break lymphoma down into two broad categories based upon the size of the lymphocyte. And the way I try to think about it is, unlike us, we're born small and we get bigger as we grow up. Lymphocytes are, when they're first created, are large, and they're called a large lymphocyte. Then they essentially go to school, learn what they're supposed to do. And unlike us, as we mature, we get bigger. As they mature, they get smaller. So for the most part, in our body, outside of our bone marrow, most of the lymphocytes are small, mature lymphocytes. The two forms of lymphoma are either of the large lymphocytes or the small lymphocytes. When it's of the large lymphocytes, it's given the term large cell lymphoma. This used to be the most common form of lymphoma, but now it's about 50-50 with the other. And traditionally, unlike in dogs and people, it doesn't tend to affect outside lymph nodes. The most common location it occurs is the GI tract. So the challenge with this form is that it does come on very quickly. So you go from a very normal cat to a cat that's not eating and is having gastrointestinal signs. And usually either through palpation, they may feel enlarged lymph nodes or an intestinal mass, or usually it's advanced imaging such as an ultrasound is able to visualize it. This is a very easy form to diagnose because we generally don't see large lymphocytes outside of the bone marrow unless we're quite ill. So traditionally, if you aspirate a lymph node or you aspirate a mass and it's filled with large lymphocytes, that is large cell lymphoma. And that is a form that needs standard chemotherapy on a weekly basis. And the hard part we have with it is only about half of them respond. If they respond and they have what we call a complete response, meaning all the disease is no longer visible, the average survival is at least a year, and about 25% are 2 years. The second form is of the small lymphocytes, so it's called small cell lymphoma. It's a form that takes a long time to come on, so it's very slow growing. So most of the patients with this have had clinical signs for weeks to months of losing weight, maybe not eating as well, and gastrointestinal signs. And the hard part with this form is things like ultrasound don't show much. Lymph nodes may be a little bit bigger than normal, and the intestines are a little thickened, and they look very much like a non-cancerous disease called inflammatory bowel disease. This form generally needs a biopsy. So whether that's through endoscopy using a scope, or whether that's through an exploratory surgery to biopsy multiple areas. On the positive side, this form is very easily treatable, and it's treatable by the owner at home with an oral steroid, prednisone or prednisolone, and an oral chemotherapeutic. That is a very, very wimpy drug called chlorambucil. And when I treat, we tend to give it Monday, Wednesday, Friday, continuously. We usually treat them for a year, and the average survival is between 2 to 3 years. So this form can do incredibly well. That's the most common cancer we see, lymphoma. Others, which are more cat-related than dog, would be a disease of the cells that make up the inside lining of the mouth, and these cells are called squamous cells. In cats, we call it squamous cell carcinoma. In people, it's a common oral cancer. We know exactly why. Usually it's either through alcohol or smoking or chewing tobacco that it develops. We're not 100% sure in cats, but it is an incredibly aggressive disease. And 98% of the cases I see are no longer surgical. So if I had a cancer I wish we had something better for, it would clearly be that cancer. Other ones that we come across, cancers of the skin called mast cell tumor, and a cancer that occurs under the skin called an injection site sarcoma.
So you see these patients after they have been diagnosed by their primary care veterinarian, is that correct?
Yeah, for the most part, only because, you know, if a primary care just has a suspicion of cancer, you know, since our cases, our day is so fully packed with patients, what we don't want is we end up having a case we work up and we find out it's not cancer when we could have had that taken off of our schedule from the start. So usually in order to make a more streamlined approach, we try to make sure we at least have an idea or a very strong inclination of the disease, or in most cases, we'd rather have confirmation.
Great. So cats vomit though. I mean, I see a lot of cats for vomiting and they do not all have cancer. So how do you sort of help guide my listeners if they're looking at their cat and it just vomits every now and then? How would you help them not be too terribly afraid of cancer in that case?
Well, I mean, we know that is a great question. And we know that, you know, a disease that cats commonly get is called inflammatory bowel disease. And with that, the result of it is they're essentially allergic to the food they're getting. So that is a very, very treatable disease, and it can cause vomiting. We can see that with them. So no cat should be vomiting, you know, a couple of times a month. You know, we know that yes, due to hairballs, we can sometimes see it. But if a cat is chronically vomiting, there's probably something going on. And the most likely cause usually is going to be inflammatory bowel disease, which is quite common in cats. On the positive side for the disease, oftentimes it's change in their diet and then the use of an oral steroid. And the vast majority of them can respond for a prolonged time period. The hard part for owners, though, is that it's not a simple diagnosis, meaning you don't just look at the cat and know that this is what it is. Oftentimes we have to have a biopsy to prove it. If not, and a veterinarian has a strong hunch that that's what it is, they could theoretically look to, you know, modify their diet to see if it helps. But traditionally, it's going to be diagnosed through a biopsy. So to me, if a cat is having chronic vomiting more than a couple times a week, they should probably be seen to rule out whether it's inflammatory bowel disease. Could it be early kidney disease? Could it be a foreign body? The cat had eaten something that is not hurting them tremendously, but it's leading to gastritis causing vomiting.
Absolutely. I think that all cats that are vomiting need to be seen by a veterinarian because the list is long and it doesn't all have to be awful. So are there any particular risk factors for development of cancer in cats? You mentioned tobacco use and alcohol use for humans, but are there any things like that in cats?
So interestingly enough, for large cell lymphoma in cats, it has been shown those growing up in smoking households are more likely to develop it. That's also the case for oral squamous cell. And when you first think of it, you're like, well, how does secondhand smoke cause, you know, cancer in their mouth or in their GI tract? And what you have to then realize is the difference between us and them in that if we're in a situation like that, well, we take a shower every day, we change our clothes. How does a cat clean themselves? Well, they groom. So these carcinogens that are floating around are landing on their fur. When they groom themselves, they concentrate in the mouth and the GI tract. So those are two causes. We do know it's also been shown in cats that have high tuna concentrations or canned tuna in one study was associated with an increased risk of oral squamous cell carcinoma. So those are at least some of them. And then there are some breed. We know that Siamese cats are more predisposed to a particular type of lymphoma, and Siamese cats are more predisposed to a skin cancer called a mast cell tumor.
What about diseases like feline leukemia? Do you ever see patients that also have feline leukemia?
So that is something that was incredibly common, you know, probably back around 20, 30 years ago. The most common form of lymphoma was a result of leukemia virus. So it's a very interesting virus. It's called a retrovirus. And what that means is the virus itself inserts some of its genetic components into our cells and associating them with our genes, meaning cat's genes in this case. And if they are inserted in the right area, they turn on what's called an oncogene. And this tells the cell to keep growing. So it's been shown that this virus can actually cause lymphoma in very, very young cats. Now, generally, clearly a non-vaccinated cat. The most common form usually occurred in the front part of the chest called the mediastinum or within their kidneys. And it was a very difficult form of lymphoma to treat. And the average survival was incredibly short for these cats. With the advent of vaccines, I think it's been about 3 years since I saw the last cat that was FELV-induced lymphoma. So thank goodness with vaccinations, we rarely see it. More so, it's cats that have been taken in from the outside that may end up having it because they were essentially wild or feral cats.
I agree. I even see it less. But since you mentioned vaccines, though, and the importance of vaccines and how vaccination has impacted certain diseases in a positive way from our perspective, let's get back to some of the injection site type cancers and give us all of your knowledge on that subject.
Sure. So it's a really interesting phenomenon how it all came about in the late 80s, a new leukemia and rabies virus vaccine had come out. And in the early 90s, the first group to really report about these sarcomas was the University of Pennsylvania, which at the time had a very, very large pathology department. And just to give you an idea, you know, you talked about I hardly see leukemia virus lymphoma anymore, but to give you an idea, within a very short period of time, they saw an increase of over 60% in sarcomas. So that's an incredible jump for any cancer. So they then started looking at, well, why was this occurring? And the location that most of these were presenting was between the shoulder blades. It was then shown that back then, that was the easiest area that we used to vaccinate cats. So they used to say it was between 1 and in every 10 to 20,000 vaccines that it occurs. Why does it occur? We think it's a couple of things. One, you have a patient that may be predisposed to cancer, and then you're giving an inciting factor. The vaccine itself causes inflammation, and cats, a subset of them, can make an overexuberant immune response against it. When that happens in a cat that's genetically predisposed, it led them to sarcoma development. Very much like the analogy would be if everybody listening smokes cigarettes, not all of us, God forbid we did, but not all of us are going to develop lung cancer. You also have to have a predisposed patient. So if you are more genetically likely to get it and you throw the inciting factor, it will happen. These were incredibly different than the traditional sarcomas in that they were very fast growing. They were very invasive. They would even work their way through bone. That's how aggressive these tumors were. And what was happening initially is the primary carers would simply cut them out, and these were growing back literally sometimes in less than 2 months. And the average survival was quite short. So that led to lots of studies on how to treat them, whether it was doing the most aggressive surgery you possibly could. And that's what's called looking at 5-centimeter margins of normal tissue around the tumor. Now think about the shoulder blades. That's almost impossible to do unless you're taking out part of their vertebrae. That's how aggressive the surgery had to be able to get them all. Because we had found if you had a tumor where they did not get everything, clearly they all grew back if you did nothing. But even if we did something such as radiation therapy to destroy that less than 1% that's left behind, many of them still recurred. That led to several different things, the use of new and different vaccines. It also led to the fact that, you know, we realized we were vaccinating patients way too often. And part of that had to do with owners, at least in my impression, in that, you know, back then, the only way to get the owner to come back in each year was the idea of vaccines. Now we have vaccines that are once every 5 years, and we've realized that we don't need to be vaccinating them that frequently. That in and of itself has led to a massive reduction in these sarcomas. The other thing that has truly helped is we now use a rule where if you are vaccinating them, we vaccinate them in their leg. Rabies on the right, leukemia on the left. That way, if, God forbid, they were to develop it, a limb could be removed, and that would be all we might need, because the overall chance of these spreading is around 25 to 30%. So in some cases, we may offer adjuvant therapy with chemo, but in other cases, local control alone may be it. Now, the name has since changed for those who are familiar with it, in that traditionally we use the term vaccine-associated sarcoma. We have now found that it's not just vaccines. And part of that came from some really interesting data from the ophthalmopathology lab, Dr. DeBielczyk at University of Wisconsin, where they looked at cats that had had penetrating foreign objects in their eye, and they developed the exact same type of sarcoma. They weren't vaccinated in their eye. It had to do with the trauma. We've also seen cats develop these sarcomas at fracture sites and other trauma sites. It's also been shown in Europe, where they generally, many countries, it's unethical to spay. They receive injections of hormones. Injection sites have shown it. And if I am not mistaken, it's also been shown with some antibiotic injections. And there's also a really interesting case report where traditionally, if we do surgery, the suture or type of suture material you used underneath the skin is called absorbable suture. The body takes it away and removes it. What's above are non-absorbable. And that's the one where the doctor then comes back and clips them off about 14 days later. Well, a veterinarian had used by accident non-absorbable suture in a deep area where they were a cat had had surgery for some other reason. It developed a sarcoma off of the suture material. So clearly, that cat did not have a vaccine in that area. That cat had the suture material. So we've learned now that it's not just vaccines, and we've changed the name to injection site sarcoma. And I can tell you, when I finished my residency, I saw two of these a week. Now I see maybe one a year. Thank goodness, because they are incredibly aggressive tumors. And if we could never have to see them again, I would certainly be very, very pleased with that.
You know, it's funny. Part of the reason I reached out to you is because I saw one recently in a very, very elderly cat. I think she's 17 or 18. And I didn't start seeing her when she was going. I think she was from a rescue, and it was over her right shoulder blade. And I thought, gosh, I haven't seen one of these in so long, but they're still out there and I still want to talk about it. So I'm so glad that you are not seeing them as much either. So I want to take a quick break and then come back and talk a little bit more about treatment and care of patients that do have cancer. So we'll be right back.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your cat tree tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. cattreetray.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Nine Lives with Dr. Kat on Pet Life Radio. Dr. Craig Clifford and I are discussing cancer in cats, the types of cancer, the types of cats, and some other interesting components of cancer in cats. But I want to cover a little bit because you said some encouraging things about treatment and survival rates. So I want to talk about some of the modes of treatment that you employ.
Yeah, so at my where I am in Blue Pearl Malvern, which is in Pennsylvania, I'm very blessed in that I have, there's 4 medical oncologists, we have 2 radiation oncologists and 1 surgical oncologist. So we have a very big and a very active group. So, you know, the medical oncologist role is usually they're kind of the overseer. They're the one who first meets the owner, talks to them about how we would treat the pet. If it needs surgery, then surgery is involved and we facilitate that. If they need radiation therapy, we facilitate that with the radiation oncologist. In most of our cases, we're handling the administration of chemotherapy. And that's always a scary thing for most owners. And it's understandable because we think about people getting chemo. And the best way I can kind of describe it is when we think of a person getting chemo, their dose is essentially up at the ceiling. And on a basic level, I tend to say, you're almost killing the person to kill the cancer. When we treat animals, companion animals, dogs and cats, you would liken the intensity of their dose to be about a third less. So by lowering the intensity by a third, we change their side effect profile demonstrably. In people, depending upon the protocol we're getting, side effects could range from 50 to 80%. In cats and dogs, it's generally 10 to 20%. Now, although that's significantly less, still 10 to 20% is not zero. And the reason side effects occur goes back to really how chemotherapy works. And, you know, in my head, I conceptualize it as like a shotgun. When it goes off, it kills all cells that it comes across that are actively growing. Now, the whole point of giving it to cancer patients is cancer grows faster than most normal cells. So you're preferentially killing the cancer cells. Most cells in our body don't grow, which is why I joke with owners, we're not 100 feet tall and dogs and cats are not 10 feet tall. But we do have some cells that grow and that's where side effects come in. So clearly the most notable for a person is we lose our hair. People will go bald. In animals, we really don't see that. More so in cats, they can lose their whiskers, but that really has no impact on them whatsoever. They do not go completely bald. Our white blood cells grow, and in people, upwards of 40%, our white blood cells could hit the floor. And when they drop that low, we're predisposed to an infection. Even something as simple as a common cold can be a challenge for a person. The risk of that in a cat, in my experience, is probably less than 3%. Part of that is they're closer to being wild, so they have a much better immune system than we do. And the final cells in the body that grow are cells that line our stomach and intestines. So things like nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea are possible. And if we're giving a drug that has a propensity to affect the belly, we start anti-nausea meds before I even give it. So by getting it on board beforehand, we reduce the risk of it to less than 7%, which is very manageable. Chemotherapeutics range from being given under the skin to intravenous to some meds that are oral. And they range from aggressive to less aggressive. So there are multiple different ones. And it depends upon the cancer type that we utilize them for. Where we've made a lot of strides in veterinary medicine now is in the use of what are called supportive medications. And what I mean by that is that oftentimes owners, they view their pet's quality of life by how they're acting at home, because clearly they can't talk to us. And a lot of that is how they're eating. So now we have very strong anti-nausea medications that can reduce the risk of nausea massively versus not giving it. And we have appetite stimulants. We have one that is a simple transdermal on the ear called Mirataz. The active compound is called mirtazapine. And it's an interesting drug because it gained its attention in the 50s. It was used as a behavior drug. So it was an antidepressant. And one of the side effects was people ate more. And we see in cats, it can work quite well with their appetite. And then we have a liquid weight gain drug called Bilura, which takes a normal protein that's made in our brain. It's a hormone called ghrelin, called the hunger hormone. And when it's released by the brain, it tells the body, you're hungry, so you eat. So some smart people created a synthetic version of it. Very little side effects associated with it. In one of the studies, some of the patients drooled, and they didn't drool because they were nauseous. They drooled because they were hungry. So that is an easy one that we can give. So having these supportive meds takes away some of the risks and some of the chance of side effects with chemotherapeutics. So these are things I try to focus on with owners that we've made strides in, because having these supportive meds is very important. Because if you and I are getting chemo and we're sick, we understand why we're ill. If they're receiving chemotherapy, clearly they don't have the wherewithal to know that, oh, I just got chemo, that's why I don't feel well. And we have to watch them go through it. So for many owners, if they went through the same types of side effects you and I did, they certainly would not treat. So by having these supportive meds, it provides a benefit for them. Most of our appointments are outpatient. The patient comes in, we draw blood work, we do an exam, we calculate a dose, we treat, and they go home. They're usually in and out within an hour. And we also try to make sure when it's weeks that are just routine blood work, that the primary care doctor is involved. And the reason I think that's very important is severalfold. One, I'm usually a much farther distance for the owner. So to me, it makes sense to have the primary involved in case something small were to happen. But if I've done everything with me and I'm asking for their help just through my notes, that's a big ask. But if they've been seeing the patient intermittently, it's much easier. Plus, it saves travel time for the owner and certainly better for the cat, as the vast majority of cats clearly don't love the car. And the other reason is the vet has been with that owner usually since they were a kitten. So to me, it's crazy to not have them involved as part of the team fighting the cancer.
I love being a part of the team. I love getting all the notes because they want to hear what I think, because they do know me and I've seen the cat, you know, for a long time. So do you have any specific advice for my listeners if they have a cat, maybe a young cat, ways that they could reduce cancer risk for that cat?
I mean, certainly making sure that they are up to date on their vaccines, making sure that they are being fed a good diet. And, you know, the idea of a good diet certainly varies, but, you know, a well-reputable company, because one of the challenges we have is that there doesn't appear to be a massive amount of overlooking by the government with a lot of these food companies. And as you know, Kat, you know, we see every week another company is having their food pulled due to some reason or another. So making sure that they're fed a well-balanced diet, making sure you're coming in for your routine checkups. One of the biggest things I would say is that when you have an older pet, don't automatically think that if they're slowing down or not eating as well or sleeping more or interacting less, that's just because they're old. That could be a sign of cancer. So if you're concerned about anything, you should definitely be seen. But having good routine wellness checks with your veterinarian are going to be the best ways that you can stay on top of things.
I think that is a great way to wrap it up, because I think that you've made sure that my listeners understand that cancer is not always a death sentence, because cats can respond really well to treatment and have a good quality of life. So I really, really appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge and expertise with us to help cats everywhere to benefit. So thank you.
Happy to do so. And the last thing I did not mention, which has been very helpful for us, is myself and my nurses and all of the other doctors, we are all fear-free certified. So for those who are not familiar, this involves really kind of looking at cats, all animals, but in this case, looking at cats differently than we do dogs, and trying to minimize what we used to do, which was, unfortunately, in veterinary medicine, a lot of what I would call manhandling them, where you're using physical force, and that's not going to work, and it only sets up bad experiences. So having places that are fear-free certified ensures they're going to do everything they can to make the visit as comfortable as possible for your pet.
Okay, I didn't tell you to say that, but everybody that listens to my show knows how important that is to me. I'm the world's first fear-free certified professional, and my practice is a fear-free certified practice. So I did not tell you to say that, but you said it anyway.
No, I recently took the course because I was doing a lecture for them. So they asked me to take the course to be certified to do it. And, you know, at first I got a bit, I went in with a jaundiced eye, but a lot of it that came out, I thought was incredibly beneficial. And it was things I just had not thought of. So for me, it has really been helpful.
Yeah, I love it. I loved it enough that I authored one of the level two modules. It has changed my life. So thank you so much. So I think that the take home message that my listeners should take is that you should be paying attention to your cat. If you're noticing weight loss or vomiting or not seeing your regular veterinarian in a methodical way, it would be a really good idea. Do you agree, Dr. Clifford?
100% agree with you.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today. And of course, I want to thank my producer, Mark Winter, because without him, Nine Lives with Dr. Cat would not exist. And I want all of my listeners to go out and have a perfect day.
Let's Talk Pets every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.